You're listening to 2A Radio with Bill Carnes.
Hey, good morning. I wanted to, I forgot to do something yesterday. I got a question about a fellow with a Saiga 12 shotgun and asked all about different things to do with it. One of the things he had asked about was, should he put a light, like a Surefire or Streamlight type of light, combat type of small, high lumen, high candle power light on the shotgun. And guys, that's always a good idea. It's best to do it if you can get the tail cap, which goes over the end of the thing. First of all, it should be light that has a momentary on and off. That's the way it works. And you can get the tail cap, which extends out to a lead that has a pressure switch on it. So you take the tail cap off, you put a new tail cap on that has a wire coming out of it, and it goes to a pressure pad, and you attach that somewhere to the forend in an ergonomic spot. So when you have a good forend grip on the shotgun, you can get to it. Not that you'll always have it on and off. You have to learn how to use a light properly. It's not turn it on and walk around like what you'd see in the movies. Where that light is, that's where all the fire in the room is going to be drawn. Oh, hey, look, that's the source of the light. Let's shoot there because somebody's manning that light. So you will definitely have to learn proper flashlight technique. Maybe we'll do a show on that or something. So the answer to the question is yes, a good tactical light. And here's the other thing, is that light should be mounted forward towards the end of the muzzle. Not all the way to the end, but pretty far out there. The reason if it's back too far, the further back it is, it's probably going to be mounted to the side or underneath. It's going to shadow that part of the gun. So you're just not going to be able to see above, right above the side or to the opposite side that the light is mounted. If the light is mounted on the left side of the forend, then you're not going to be able to see to the right of the barrel very well because it's going to be masked because the barrel and forend are in the way if the light is mounted too far to the rear. So mount it further forward. Good, secure, solid mounting system. Surefire makes good lights. Streamlight makes good lights. There's some others out there. You can get some of these cheap ones from places like Cheaper Than Dirt. When we're talking about putting something on a 12-gauge shotgun, I don't suggest going with the cheapy models or the off-brands or something that's going to cost you $18. Don't do it. The more expensive models, they have a lot more research. They get better battery life. They are more durable. You get more lumens out of less energy. The LED lights have come a long way in the last 4 years or so. Those are something definitely to look at. You can even get replacement LED heads for lights now. You can take the standard head off and then put an LED LED head on top. And replace it, which ends up oftentimes working wonderfully. Tremendous amount of battery light. The life of the battery is extended, exponentially. It's wonderful. And excellent light. Very, very bright white light downrange. So good stuff on that. But if you go with the cheapy light, it's just not going to put up with the pounding or the abuse of moving a gun around, throwing it around, especially in a 12-gauge. Some standard lights don't put up with the abuse of a 12-gauge. I have a standard, like a nice Surefire on my 12-gauge shotgun, and the bulb broke on it once. I now have an LED head on it, so the bulb will not break. And that was on a fairly low recoil 12-gauge with the Vancomp system on it and the porting, and that gun doesn't have a bunch of recoil to it, especially with the rounds that I use. So even a good light broke on that. I had to change some parts out so it wouldn't happen again. Definitely do not go with the cheapy light on a 12-gauge shotgun because you know it's going to fail when? Exactly when you need it. So we want to avoid that at all costs. You don't want to have that happening. We're going to have plenty to come. We are expecting Jim Dunsing to actually call in today and give his firsthand account later in the show of what happened at the Eric Scott Coroner's Inquest on Tuesday afternoon when they came back with a justified ruling. When we come back, we're going to talk about Denver's militarized police. So stay tuned. We'll be right back after these words.
not an option. It's a right. Cocked, locked, and ready to rock the world of the anti-gunners. You are listening to the guy who had to register his mouth as a full auto weapon. Bill Carnes and Two-Way Radio. The fight for your rights isn't for pansies. So buckle up for the ride and knuckle down with Bill Carnes and 2A Radio.
This morning, guys, we are going to start 2A Radio with an article entitled Criminals with Badges, Denver's Militarized Police. It says, I've been forced to write my own laws, and you violate one in there, I just have to find you guilty of contempt of cop. Now, could you imagine a cop actually saying that? I've been forced to write my own laws, and if you violate one that's in there, I just have to find you guilty of contempt of cop. So you're going to create the law, decide whether or not somebody violates it, and then adjudicate the law as the jury as well. Okay, well, Bumper Morgan, I believe that's a cop in Denver. He's one of Joseph Wamba's Blue Knights, and I believe Joseph Wamba is the chief of police there. He was justifying his brutal assault on a young man who had casually insulted him. Now, listen to this. Jared Lund, a 21-year-old volunteer firefighter from Brighton, Colorado, visited Denver's Lodo district to celebrate a friend's birthday. The evening was quite pleasant until Jared, who was carrying a pizza and minding his own business, was suddenly punched in the face and knocked flat by someone he had never met. Shortly after the assault, the assailant scurried away. The police arrived, and Jared's night took a pronounced turn for the worse. Perhaps Jared was unaware of the axiom that it's never a good idea to ask the police for help. Perhaps the fact that he is involved in a public safety role, Jared, to assume that the police would treat him with any sort of courtesy or professionalism, got the following. In any case, Jared told Officer Eric Sellers that he had just been assaulted and that he wanted to press charges. Sellers told the victim to go home, and he wasn't impressed with Jared's appeal to him as a fellow officer, as a fellow public servant. Then he says, way to protect and serve, muttered Jared in disgust as he walked away. A violent assault on a mere mundane is a trivial matter, but this was a clear-cut case of contempt of cop, as we mentioned earlier, and it could not go unpunished because the kid said, way to protect and serve. Sellers, the cop, seized Jared and threw him to the ground while screaming a steady stream of profanities at the terrified young man. Sellers beat him and applied a vicious chokehold. After Jared's body went limp, Sellers wrenched his hands behind his back and handcuffed him with such violence that the victim wouldn't have full use of his hands for a week. The felonious assault took place in the presence of two other police officers who, in the keeping with the oath-bound discipline of their brotherhood, refused to intervene. This guy, Sellers, does this all the time, one of the bully's comrades, Chris Fuchs, said as an eyewitness on November 23rd, 2008, which is when the assault took place. After Jared was released, he said, we don't know how he gets away with it. The obvious reply would be, well, he gets away with it because the guilty collaboration of the good cops like you don't do anything. So what they have is a heavy-handed cop. 2 months later, Sellers became annoyed with a young man named John Crispin, whose behavior struck the officer as nosy. Sellers pulled up in the driveway of John's home and ordered the young man out of the car. As John complied, his shoulder brushed lightly against Sellers' arm. Infuriated that a mundane citizen had defiled his sanctified personage, through incidental contact, Sellers inflicted a dose of summary street justice as an act of ritual purification. Just as he did to Jared Lund, Sellers put John in a chokehold while spitting obscenities in his face. After handcuffing the victim, Sellers used his police baton to lift the young man a couple of feet from the ground, then dropped him face first onto the driveway. The representative of the Denver City Government Punitive Priesthood dragged the bloodied man off the pavement, draped him over the hood of the police car, and administered the laying on of hands. The victim said, "He started punching me in the sides while I was already handcuffed," he told the NBC affiliate of Denver later. "I told him to quit, and he wouldn't quit. He did it one more time and grabbed my face and said, 'Who the F do you think you are?'" After being beaten into a lumpy mess, John Crispin, despite the absence of a criminal history, was charged with felony menacing. Terrified and worried about being separated from his newborn child, Crispin accepted a plea bargain agreement that resulted in probation. His only crime was having his ass whipped by this Denver cop. Sellers was later found to have used inappropriate force against Jared Lund. The same review found that the officer had compounded the offense through the commission of a deceptive act, that is, lying to internal affairs investigators. According to the Denver PD's existing disciplinary guidelines, that is cause for presumptive termination. Yet Sellers continues to draw a paycheck as a member of the police force in Denver. In fact, Sellers, who according to his colleagues commits criminal assaults against innocent people, quote, all of the time, complained in a court filing that the disciplinary action against him was excessive, because it specified that another episode of that kind would result in immediate termination. Okay, they've been putting up with your garbage for way too long, and they told you if you do it again, you're going to get canned. And you think that's excessive. Guys, this is the type of cop that the citizens should get together and bind, gag, and arrest. The citizens should overwhelm this kind of authoritative, oath-breaking, constitution-neglecting pile of garbage. And the citizen should take control of this guy and take him down and throw his ass in jail. Now, Denver's Citizen Oversight Board insists correctly that Sellers should have been fired already and prosecuted as well. The Denver Police Protective Association, of course, the union, has Sellers back, of course. That's what they're supposed to do. If Sellers is gone, they don't get his union dues. It isn't surprising, given that in September 2008, just weeks before Sellers assaulted Jared Lund, the Denver Police Union distributed T-shirts to its members depicting a baton-wielding riot cop rising anonymously about the city skyline, ominously, pardon me, around the city skyline. And so they're there to keep everybody in line. They say, "We get up early to beat the crowds," is what the inscription said on the shirt. Interesting. "We get up early to beat the crowds." Nice. Each member of the Denver PD received one of the commemorative T-shirts, which were created in anticipation of the 2008 Democratic National Convention. Sellers apparently perceived this ill-advised pun as a directive and took it to what passes for his heart. Interestingly, Sellers owes his continued employment to a figure who played a critical role in the militarized security preparations for the 2008 convention, Ron Perea, who until recently was manager of safety for the city of Denver. Perea was a Secret Service special agent in charge during the 2008 Democratic National Convention. His previous experience included a stint as head of Denver's field office for the Secret Service, a position on the executive board of the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force in L.A., and 5 years on the Albuquerque Police Department. It's difficult to imagine someone whose career offers a better score sample of contemporary law enforcement at all levels. So it's quite significant that Perea, as safety manager, defined his job in terms of protecting the career prospects of abusive police rather than protecting the public. As safety manager, Perea had the final say regarding complaints of excessive force. His decisions reflected an obvious desire to placate the demands of the police union rather than holding abusive cops accountable for their offenses. So it's interesting. This guy had the final say regarding complaints of excessive force. I believe that the way the Constitution is written, that it goes into the hands of the district attorney's office, who has the final say. Not some Yahoo with the Secret Service. He's in the executive branch. Okay? The district attorney's office is kind of mired between executive and judicial branch. They're the ones who are supposed to get it for prosecution. Now, Perea resigned his post on October 31st, barely 3 months into his $150,000 a year job, because of rising public disgust over his handling of several recent episodes of criminal violence by Denver PD. In addition to the leniency he had displayed towards Sellers, Perea refused to discipline officer Devin Sparks, who severely beat Michael DeHerrera on a Lodo street corner in April of 2009. So, all we're having is a whole bunch of wicked beatings by select number of unchecked cops in Denver. I gotta tell you, I don't know why people lay down for the cops so much. It's like, well, they'll just beat me worse, they'll beat me worse. You know, I gotta tell you something. If there's somebody who deserves a whipping, and I might end up with the short end of the stick, but they're gonna damn well know the next several mornings that they had it out with me, I'm okay with that. But that's just me. I'm willing to lay it down. That's just me. So I wouldn't tolerate this kind of garbage. It's easy for me to say that. However, I backed it up several times in my own life. Anyhow, guys, enough of that. We're going to move on after the break. Stay tuned. I'm your host, Bill Carnes. You're tuned in live right here to 2A Radio. RoninTactical.com has certified concealed carry training specialists that travel to you and your group of self-protection advocates. Organize a group of friends, family, or co-workers who take their responsibility of self-protection seriously, and RoninTactical.com will send out a certified training specialist who will provide a course of instruction that will get you and your group certified to carry concealed in over 30 states while providing you, the organizer, a commission for organizing the event. Do you travel for work, family, or vacation and want to remain armed and safe when traveling? Contact RoninTactical.com for details on staying home and having one of our certified professionals travel to you to provide the training and credentials for you and your group to safely and legally carry concealed in over 30 states. Call 888-416-4809 or go online to RoninTactical.com.
Tell everyone in the room to pipe down. 2A Radio with Bill Carnes is back.
Hi, guys. Welcome back. You know, again, we have a story about this scumbag in the Oval Office. Obama, again, omits the word creator when speaking of inalienable rights cited in the Declaration of Independence. This is twice in a week. Just 7 days after he sparked controversy by omitting the word creator, when he closely paraphrased the passage from the Declaration of Independence that says all men are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, Obama again omitted the creator when speaking about the inalienable rights that everybody is endowed with. This time, Obama was speaking at a September 22nd fundraiser for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee and the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee at the Roosevelt Hotel in New York City. And he referenced his reference to inalienable rights was not as close a paraphrasing of the Declaration as it had been the week prior. Here's a quote. And what was sustaining us was that... And what was sustaining us was that sense that the North Star, the sense that, you know, we have to stay true to our values. If we believe that all people are created equal and everybody is endowed with certain inalienable rights, and we're going to make those words live, we're going to give everybody opportunity, everybody a ladder into the middle class, every child able to go as far as their dreams will take them. If we stay true to that, then we're going to be able to maintain the energy and focus, the fight, the gumption to get stuff done. That's what he said, according to the transcript posted by the White House. And it's interesting also that he talks about in here about everybody, a ladder to the middle class. If everybody's middle class, where's the lower class? It disappears, right? A large middle class sustains the country. A small lower class and a small upper class also help sustain the country. It all works out. If you're not in the class you want to be in, then that sucks. I'm sorry. But that's just the way the society is. And nobody, including the government, can drag everybody out of the lower class up into the middle class. Some of those wouldn't even do it anyhow, like leading a horse to water. You can't make him drink. Same thing with a certain segment of society. Now, speaking at the Congressional Hispanic Caucus Institute annual awards gala on September 15th, the week before, Obama left out the word creator when otherwise virtually quoting from the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, endowed, leaving out by their creator, with certain inalienable rights, life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. That's what makes us unique. That's what he said. Obama's omission of the creator from a September 15th reference to the declaration was noted and discussed on national talk radio and television programs. Even Rush Limbaugh played an audio clip of the relevant passage of Obama's remarks at the Congressional Hispanic Caucus Institute dinner on his September 20th program. Now, it's interesting. The Congressional Hispanic Caucus, racist organization, because they name Hispanic in there. They are filled with Hispanics. Now, there's also a Congressional Black Caucus, racist organization, because you have to be black to be in there. There's also the Congressional Women's Caucus, sexist organization, because you got to be a woman to be in there. Can you have the Congressional Men's Organization? Can you have the Congressional Anglo-Saxon Organization? No, because those would immediately be thought to be sexist and racist. I'm not saying that you should have those. I'm saying if you can't have them, if they're looked at as sexist and racist, you better make this a two-way street, morons, and consider them all sexist and racist. That was one of my big hang-ups with now Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor. Virtually every organization she belonged to, but one, which is the New York Bar Association, were either all women organizations or all Latino-Hispanic organizations. All but New York Bar. Sexist, racist. That's a sexist, racist mindset. And people can deny it. If you are a sexist or a racist, you can deny it because you're in the mindset of the sexist and the racist. We need to either allow all of them or end all of them. I don't really care which one we do. We just need to either allow them all or end them all. That's it. I'm sorry. It's like your local chamber of commerce, right? You can have the women's chamber of commerce. You can have the Asian chamber of commerce, the Latino chamber of commerce, the African American chamber of commerce. You can even have the Jewish chamber of commerce if you want. You can have the Islamic chamber of commerce if you want. As long as you're putting some religious, racial, or sexist word in that arena, it is a sexist, religious, or racist organization that others who are not part of your sex, race, or religion are not allowed to be in. And if you discriminate against someone's sex, race, or religion, what are you in violation of? The Civil Rights Act of 1965. Imagine that. And they're allowing it in Congress. Violation of the Civil Rights Act. Right there in Congress, and Obama's speaking to him and disavowing the Creator. The one sin that God himself, Almighty God himself, will not tolerate is disavowing his existence. Stay tuned, guys. Plenty more to come with a call from Jim Dunsing on the Eric Scott inquest decision after the break.
You're listening to a guy who packs a gun to shoot the bad guys and packs a mic to shoot his mouth off. Bill Carnes and Two-Way Radio are back.
Welcome back from the break, everybody. On the line, we have Jim Dunsing. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Morning.
Jim. Hey, how are you, man?
Excellent.
Now, I understand yesterday you just plain after all of the mayhem of this case, actually got a little bit of extra rest yesterday. Congratulations to you. And wondering if you could walk us through the final day, Tuesday. Now, and as we discussed on Monday, they'd expected this thing to go on, this inquest to go on several more days, maybe even have to take a week break for a judge's vacation and come back and do even a more couple of days. So tell us, what happened on Tuesday to get this thing sent to the inquest jury so soon, and what led up to that?
They had the final two shooters testify, along with the coroner and a couple of other, like a crime scene investigator, and then wrapped up the case and were done by 3:30, and the jury deliberated for 2 hours. But the last two officers were Stark and Mendiola. Stark fired once. Mendiola fired four times. And because of the way the process is set up, they weren't able to follow up any of the memorized answers and get at actual information. For instance, Mendiola testified that he still perceived Eric to be a threat for each of the four shots he fired. Well, you know, and I know that means that he had to actually analyze the situation between each of those four shots.
Yeah, shoot and assess,
A perception.
Yeah.
To find that he still had a gun.
Well, you know,
and,
what,
but he was allowed to get off with that kind of non-specific answer.
You know, I got to tell you, Jim, that's interesting because shoot and assess is one of these deals that it would be easy enough to find out how quick he fired the shots by taking the 911 recording that caught all of the shooting in time sequence. Could you really shoot and assess that quickly between bam, 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 bam sort of thing? The answer is absolutely not. You and I both know this. Anybody that's done any sort of real-life defensive training or ever had to shoot at another human being knows this. And, of course, he can't get cross-examined.
Right.
Anyway,
but, yeah, you can listen to the tape and you can hear those four shots and very, very rapidly.
So they actually did play the 911 recording?
They did. They didn't play it that day. They played it earlier in the week. They played it while Shai Lyerly was testifying.
Okay, gotcha.
Or Mosier, one of the two. But they played it before Mosier, I think, during the Lyerly testimony, because you can hear while he's on the line with 911, you can hear the screaming and the shots fired.
Curiously. What about the radio traffic? Did they ever release the radio? Have the radio traffic played in court?
I believe they played segments of it, but not the whole thing. I don't believe they've released the tape to the family so they could ask to hear specific sections. I believe the first time they heard a bunch of those recordings was during the hearing itself.
Well, I know they heard some of it on this show because there's a group of folks out there across the country, and all of them, wherever there is a metropolitan police department that does not have encrypted radio traffic, and Las Vegas Metro doesn't, they record all available channels. And this same group released their copy of the unedited radio traffic, and they posted it on the internet. I got it. We played it. I cut out all of the downtime just so there wasn't a bunch of silence and code red beeping. But it is available out there, and I know that Bill Scott said that he listened to it. My question, what I'm really curious is, if Metro officially releases it, if it's exactly the same, I would imagine it is, and I'd hope that they would officially release the 911 call, which they generally do as well, especially after the inquest. It would be interesting to see all of that come out so we can compare what we heard in the inquest hearing and also what was put out when it comes to the radio traffic on the internet before. But anyhow, carry on. Tell us how this whole thing was going.
Well, they, like I said, they had Mendiola come up and they asked him a few questions and nothing very specific. He never really testified that he saw, after any shot, he saw a gun in Eric's hands that he... Any shot that he fired, he didn't really describe his new assessment and why Eric was still a threat. They let him off the hook on that. Stark only fired the one round. He testified that he believes all the shooting was done by the time he fired his round. Nobody testified that they were, that they had fired their weapons once, Eric was already on the ground. However, given the number of times that, Mendiola fired and the way he believes he reassessed the situation for each of his, you know, his shots that went off within less than a second of each other, my guess, if I had to bet, would be that he fired the round, while Eric was lying, flat on the ground.
Interesting. So you, we're thinking that, that that's the guy that actually fired the last kind of screw you round into his back.
I think Stark seemed to be a very level-headed guy. Mendiola seemed to be much more of a he had some military experience and seemed to be much more kind of eager and ready to shoot. And like, well, he did. He shot four times to Stark's one. The same incident, but given that, it's my guess that he just shot and followed him down and kept firing until it was obvious to everyone that there was no more life in Eric Scott. The witnesses there that saw it, that were paying attention, saw Eric drop to the ground on his knees and gasp for air, probably because of a thoracic shot to the lung, and this cop fired after that, after like a 2 second break of Eric with his hands up, gasping for air, if you believe some of the witnesses.
Well, yeah, because if but he's again, still gasping no for problems. Air, if he's still gasping for air, he can testify against him later.
Yeah, that's probably the case.
Unreal. And that's not too dissimilar, Jim, when the Las Vegas Metro cop who shot you now, what, about 11 months ago, for running away from him because he was tasing you because he didn't want to have the conversation that you wanted to have for exercising your First Amendment rights, he shot you. And it, first of all, there was a hospital right down the street. It took him some time to get you loaded into the an ambulance, and then they took you about 12 miles away to a different hospital rather than the one that was right there.
Right. Well, one of the officers told dispatch, and I still haven't heard this dispatch call. Totally, they haven't released that to us. But one of the officers told dispatch, "No, it's just the bad guy who's down. Send the ambulance." And then several minutes later, I get the ambulance, and we don't go two blocks away to the, I think it's called Sunrise Hospital. We go several blocks away to UMC, which I think has the best trauma unit in the city. But when you've got a brachial artery injury, like I was believed to have, time is of the essence, and an extra minute or two or four could very well have meant death.
Interesting. Yeah, it seems like the onus is certainly on protecting the cops, taking care of the cops, and they're the servants. You know, rather than taking care of the people who are actually the citizens. And that's just the mentality of police in this era, because they don't consider themselves police. They consider themselves law enforcement. I don't know if you happened to hear the segment where I was speaking about Denver earlier in the show, where just before the 2008 convention, the police union in Denver issued shirts to everybody who's a member of the Denver Police Department that had depicted a cop with a baton soaring over the city, and it says, "We wake up early to beat the citizens," or whatever it was. And that, yeah, exactly. And that issues a mentality. That right there is a completely subversive mindset. You know, Jim, yesterday, I don't know if you caught wind of it, but I'm going to go through the Las Vegas Review-Journal article of Gillespie having a press conference yesterday about this inquest. And he says, "While the jury rendered a ruling of justified, and while I believe our officers acted appropriately, there are no winners here. Gillespie expressed sympathy to Scott's family and friends who have spent thousands of dollars on billboards asking the department to release any video of the incident and slamming the inquest process as biased in favor of police. He says, although I don't pretend to know what they're going through, the grief of the Scott family is understandable," Gillespie said, adding that, "While a family used to seeing their loved ones in a positive light, when officers encounter them and they are not usually at their best." Now, what Gillespie said in this entire press conference, you and I could have sat down and written what was going to come out in advance. I mean, there's no surprises here. We knew what he was going to say. He's going to say, look, yeah, it's, we're not proud of what happened, but I stand behind my cops, and they did the right thing, and the inquest process might not be perfect, but it's what we've got, and it came through, and I believe the outcome. I wonder what he would have said if it came back as criminal. Well, we're going to have to look at that and work with the DA, because even though they said it was criminal, it's unofficial, and we're going to see if there actually was anything criminal before the DA would even consider filing charges. I'd imagine that would have been the press conference there. But this whole thing just stinks to heaven, and I got to tell you, Gillespie's up for re-election. And who's he going against? Is it Lori Bisch is her name?
Lori Bisch, yeah.
B-I-S-C-H. And she's just a street cop. And, well, as far as I know, she's an officer. She's not a sergeant or anything above that. She's a police officer, too, is her rank. I don't know where she works. I don't know if she works patrol or she's a detective. I don't know. But she ran last time and got beat handedly in the primary 4 years ago. But I got to tell you, I don't really care who it is. I'd like to see Gillespie absolutely turned on his ear in this election, thanks in large part to this Eric Scott case and how it was handled. And I would love to see him turned on his ear and Lori Bisch be the next sheriff. I really would.
Well, I wouldn't be excited, frankly, to see Lori Bisch as the next sheriff. I had a meeting with her, and the only real good thing that came out of it was she stated that if she were sheriff, she would end the blue card process. But she also tried to convince me that the Trevon Cole shooting was part of a negligent discharge, and that there was no corruption in the department when that video went missing at Costco.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, so it sounds like she's part, even though she hasn't actually made it through the rank, she's already got the mentality of the old boys club and protect what you've got. Which is, I mean, it's interesting because if you are an officer and you have really no rank and you're in the department, you would generally not do something like step out of rank and run for sheriff, who is several. I mean, like, she's got to have seven people between her and the sheriff when it comes to the, the ranking order there. What is the term?
Hierarchy.
There's actually more of a military term. They use it there anyhow. Yeah, the chain of command. There's got to be six, seven people between her and sheriff in the chain of command. And she steps out of ranks to run for sheriff. You would think she's going to be disgruntled and want to see some real changes, not just have a power grab. But it sounds like if she's saying, oh, no, everything is on the up and up, it's all good, really interesting. And the Devin Cole thing is a negligent discharge? Well, the negligence, there's also something called negligent homicide, which is what it would have been. But no, it was justified, even negligence, because it was a cop. Now, if you or I were in the shoes of the cops and had done all the different things the cops have been doing, shooting the kid with the basketball, blowing Devin Cole's head off in the bathroom with an AR-15, killing Eric Scott outside of Costco, you and I, what would be happening to us? We'd be hung up by a yardarm, man.
As well we should be, and they'd probably be able to find the video.
Probably. Now, when you put up the thing on your Facebook page, If I Did It, and cited a Las Vegas Metro detective, just curiously, where did that come from? Because that was really pretty neat.
That came from my sitting there and listening to all the witnesses come on and describe what they did at the crime scene.
Oh, so you created that.
Coupled with my legal analysis of the situation. And it left us with only a couple conclusions. And the tape didn't just disappear.
Interesting. Yeah, I thought that was very creative. I didn't know who had written it, where it had come from. Now we know the source. And I really enjoyed that. You know, it was taken in the theme of the O.J. Simpson book, If I Did It, after the Ron Goldman and Nicole Simpson murders. Basically, it was a confessional account, if anybody actually spent any money on the book. I perused it, but I perused someone else's copy. I wasn't about to spend a dime on it and see anything potentially go to OJ or his trust or anything such as that. So, interesting stuff. Jim, thanks a bunch for calling. We got about a minute or so left. Are there any summaries that you'd like to put together on this entire inquest process that we just witnessed?
Well, there was a lot of, and I don't know the full story, but a lot of the family was upset several occasions with several different things that the officers said, which are contrary to their understanding of the events. That apparently Samantha's Eric's girlfriend, was not allowed to leave the area, go check on Eric. They kind of denied that, and Samantha didn't testify. But
that's right. As a matter of fact, she ignored the subpoena, and they couldn't even find her to bring her in. They just used her taped debrief.
Well, and apparently she wasn't properly served. But I was in the hallway when one of the last witnesses to testify that Eric had a .380 Ruger in his pocket that he had bought like a year plus ago, had a blue card for, but it didn't have added to his CCW.
Yeah, we talked about that on the show yesterday. So they're saying that would have been a felony in the state of Nevada to possess a gun that's not on your CCW.
Well, here's the deal.
Hold on. We're going to break, Jim. We'll catch you in the next segment. Guys, we'll be right back. If you live in a state which allows Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories, and you either have an interest in or already own Class 3 NFA items, the process for an individual to own these items includes photographs, fingerprints, obtaining a letter of permission from your police chief or sheriff, and a full personal background check, which is spread across the whole federal system. Until now. Forming an NFA trust eliminates the requirements of letters of permission and all personal data and background checks in purchasing and possessing NFA firearms and accessories. NFA trusts offer a level of anonymity as well as flexibility in the purchasing, possessing, and storage of your Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories. To learn more about forming a secure and flexible NFA trust at a fraction of the cost from attorneys, visit www.billcarnes.com and click on the NFA tab. That's BILLCARNS.com and click on the NFA tab.
As long as politicians attack our rights, Bill will be fighting for them. Two-Way Radio with Bill Carnes is back.
Back off, I'll take you on. Headstrong to take on anyone. I know that you are wrong if this is not where you belong.
And welcome back. Jim, are you there?
I am, Bill.
All right, man, go ahead. Carry on with your thoughts as we're exiting the last segment.
As we were finishing up the last segment, I was talking about one of the last officers to testify, who was the crime scene analyst. And he testified that they recovered a .380 Ruger in Eric's right pocket and a blue card indicating he'd bought it more than a year ago but hadn't added it to his CCW permit. He hadn't requalified with that particular gun. Well, I was in the hallway between the elevators when Ross Goodman, the family attorney, showed a bloodstained blue card to a reporter with a date that was about 3 weeks prior to the shooting for that .380.
Interesting.
And, you know, I believe the law is written that you're allowed some kind of reasonable period between the purchasing of the weapon and adding it to your CCW.
I'm not sure, but we could certainly look into that. I do have the Nevada Gun, Knife, and Weapon Law Compendium. And I can look into that, so that would be an interesting thing to check out.
But at any rate, it's one more piece of information that has a discrepancy when you hear it from Metro's mouth.
You know, it's one of these things where we hoped that everybody had already seen how filthy the coroner's inquest process was, so that they would at least attempt to show it in a more reasonable light this time around, but not at all. Absolutely ran roughshod over the entire Eric Scott inquest process. Ran roughshod across the family, ran roughshod across Eric Scott's character, in an effort to just get these cops excused through some sort of justifiable or excusable circumstance. And they got their way with absolutely no shame whatsoever. And now three cops who shot this guy. It sounds like two of them were really the ones who were much more behind it. But still, three of them shot him. They all ended up one way or another. He's dead now because they shot him. Costco bears a tremendous amount of responsibility based on their 911 call and how they handled it in order to inflate the story to get the cops there. The cops get there and shoot him, and the whole entire coroner's inquest process is not there to find the truth or to see if any wrongdoing happened, but to exonerate the cops. And it's just amazing that it was filmed, it was spread across the internet, it was on live TV, they had an extra place there in the courtroom for everybody to look at it, and it doesn't really make any difference that they still just took the entire process and made a mockery of it. Guys, thanks so much for tuning in. Jim, thanks again for calling in, and we'll be back tomorrow. I'd like to close by saying, to those of you within our government, we will be watching you in Congress, the executive, and judicial branches all very closely as we organize to save our freedom, liberty, and country. We will not become the subjects of governmental rule.
Thanks for tuning in. Bill will be back tomorrow. Now go side in and shoot straight. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes. Learn more about Bill at BillCarnes.com. Send your comments to Bill at 2aradio.com. I will not.